casualties had been ludicrously low. Sickness and injury had reduced both battalions from a nominal strength of 500 men each to a combined total of just over 800. Which, for any animal-powered army Nemu Alban had ever studied, was an incredibly low sick rate. Traditionally, back on old Earth, especially in pre-industrial armies, attrition from illness had vastly exceeded combat losses. It hadn't been until the period of World War I that deaths from enemy action had actually outnumbered deaths from disease. But the Archangel Pasquale's teachings had produced a level of hygiene and preventive health measures which created a very different situation here on Safehold. None of which changed the fact that Johnston and Raisingear were outnumbered by roughly 5-1 by the cavalry waiting just on the far side of the hill. Merlin glanced at Cleric as the brigadier rode along, seemingly without a care in the world. He'd stayed with Johnston's command group, and if he was particularly concerned about Windshare, his expression showed absolutely no sign of it. The Earl of Windshare sat in his saddle, watching his retreating cavalry pickets withdraw up the hillside towards him, exactly as Major Galvan had described. The long, gradual slope behind them was dotted with the bodies of dead and wounded horses, who'd obviously been brought down by the skirmishers, moving 50 or 60 yards in advance of the main infantry column. But he saw only a very few human bodies out among them. His spyglass showed him the Carizians, marching with their rifles slung. To his considerable surprise, they were marching with fixed bayonets as well, which was more than simply odd. Bayonets were musketeers' last-ditch defense, and a clumsy substitute for proper pikes at best. Worse, men with the circular hilts of bayonets shoved down the muzzles of their muskets could neither fire nor reload. So what in the world could the Carizians be thinking of? Deep inside, a little voice suggested to him that someone like Garvai might have been able to come up with an answer short of assuming that his opponents had succumbed to lunacy. It should perhaps have occurred to him that none of his earlier reports had mentioned anything about bayonets. On the other hand, that wasn't the sort of detail cavalry scouts normally included in their reports, and at the moment, Windshare had other things on his mind. Like the fact that, bayonets or no, they were coming hard, concentrating on covering ground as quickly as they could without exhausting themselves. And the way they'd allowed themselves to become more spread out indicated that they weren't spending a lot of energy worrying.
No reason they should be, he thought grimly. We've been shadowing them, and they've been killing and wounding my men for hours now, and I doubt their maps are as good as ours. As far as they're concerned, this is just more of the same. And they probably don't even know what the ground looks like between here and Green Valley. No reason for them to think I could have over 4,000 cavalry hidden away.
He smiled hungrily, watching the enemy approach. It was going to be ticklish getting his men up and over the crest line. Not only was there the slope to consider, but the terrain would be constricted until they crossed the crest, where the fan-shaped prospective battlefield began to open out once more. No trooper liked to start a charge headed uphill for a lot of reasons, and in this instance they were going to be packed like apples in a basket, forced to adopt a deeper formation than he would have preferred until they cleared the top of the slope. On the other hand, there were those bayonets. Even if the Carizians' muskets were loaded, they'd still have to remove the bayonets before they could fire, and his troopers would have the downslope on the far side to help them build and maintain speed once they got started. The trick was going to be timing. He needed to start the charge soon enough to give his men time to come over the hill and gain speed, but at the same time, He wanted to give the Carizians as little time as possible to react.
Still, he thought, studying those slung muskets, surprise is bound to keep them from reacting instantly.
Merlin had deliberately looked away from Clarake. In fact, he'd turned in the saddle to look back down the length of the column behind them, to where the first battery of 12-pounders had just come through the belt of trees in road column. It probably wasn't strictly necessary, but he wanted to make it clear to any potential observer that he wasn't even thinking about the Brigadier at this particular moment. Of course, he wasn't really looking at the column either, as he waited, watching and listening through his snark.
Now! Windshare snapped, and Major Galvan stood in the stirrups, waving the red signal flag vigorously.
Merlin might not have been watching Clarake, but the Brigadier had been very attentively, if unobtrusively, watching him. Which was why the Marine saw the bodyguard reach up and remove his helmet in order to wipe sweat from his brow.
Now, I think, Brian, he said crisply.
Major Lofton looked at him for just a moment, then glanced up the slope before them. Obviously, he couldn't imagine what had prompted Clarake to give the order at that precise moment, but it was an order he'd been expecting. He hesitated for no more than a heartbeat, then nodded to the bugler at his side.
"Sound form square, Corporal," he said.
Windshare's masked horsemen started up the slope, first at a walk, but moving rapidly to a trot, with the smoothness of years of experience and the demanding training Windshare had put them through, ever since assuming command of Garvey's cavalry. The lead squadrons reached the crest in an 8-deep line, moving at a hard trot, covering just over 200 yards per minute, and the front two ranks accelerated rapidly. By the time they'd covered another 40 yards, they were moving at a full, extended gallop, hooves showering clods of moist earth, lances and sabers glittering in the sunlight, while the next two ranks thundered along 30 yards behind them. About them and behind them came the music of bugles, the drumming thunder of 16,000 hooves, and a deep baying cheer as they turned on their enemies at last. Windshare himself came over the crest with the third double line, 60 yards behind the first. He rode in the exact center of the line, his standard snapping and popping in the wind of his passage, and his eyes glittered with fierce satisfaction. But then those eyes widened in astonishment. The men of Clarake's first two battalions had been waiting for the bugle call, and they responded instantly. Both battalions unraveled, moving with the speed and precision only endless, brutally demanding drill could have instilled. They spread out, 1st Battalion moving to its right, while 2nd Battalion moved to its left, forming not a column, not a line, but a single hollow formation. It wasn't literally a square, the ground was too uneven for that, and it was more of a rectangle than a square anyway. But that compact, steady, unshaken, unsurprised formation bristled with bayonets, facing outward in every direction, and in direct contravention of every standard safety regulation, the rifles upon which those bayonets were mounted had been carefully loaded and primed before they were ever slung. Windshare couldn't believe it. He'd never seen infantry move that quickly, that precisely, even on the drill field. Surely there was no way they could have responded that instantly. It wasn't possible. Yet the Carizians had done it, and it was too late for him to change his own mind. Half his total force, including Windshare himself, was already at a full gallop, pounding downhill towards the enemy at over 7 yards a second in a series of lines which were each 125 men across. His lead elements had little more than 150 yards to go, and the front rank of the second half of his force was already moving up and over the crest line behind him, ready to exploit his charge's success.
"And the bastards still have their damned bayonets fixed, too," he realized, and grinned savagely. "They may think they'll keep my lads from closing with them, but they're about to find out just how wrong they are."
Brigadier Clerc sat his horse in the middle of 1st Battalion Square, watching the enemy come. His expression was as calm as ever as he glanced over at Merlin.
"I suppose this is where we find out just how clever I really am," he remarked.
The front of his square, where it faced uphill, was 3 ranks deep instead of 2. The front rank knelt on 1 knee, rifle butts braced, bayonets thrusting up and out at a sharp angle, right about at chest height on a horse. The second and third ranks waited, rifles cocked. The temptation to fire as soon as possible was almost overwhelming as they watched 2,000 cavalry thundering towards them, but they didn't. They waited. Colonel Johnston waited with them. His battalion formed the long side of the square closest to the enemy, and he dismounted to stand beside the battalion standard, sword in hand, his eyes on the enemy. There wouldn't be time to reload before the first wave was upon them, whatever happened, and he had no intention of wasting the shock value of a massed volley by firing too soon. It wasn't just a matter of range or accuracy, it was also a matter of timing, of hitting those cavalrymen not simply with the physical impact of his Marines' bullets, but with their morale effect as well, and doing it at precisely the right moment. The Coruscantian cavalry thundered downhill, opened up into proper double lines. Now the leading troopers tightened in the saddle, bracing for impact as they hurtled straight at the Carizian formation. The hedge of unwavering bayonet points glittered wickedly in the early afternoon sunlight, but at least they weren't pikes. In another few seconds, the universe came apart in a sudden, thunderous roll of rifle fire. There were roughly 800 men in the Carizian Square, with 4 platoons, roughly 80 men, in each of its short sides, covering either flank. Another 100 men formed its rear face, facing downhill, covering the backs of the 220 men in its front face. And a 40-man reserve stood ready in the middle of the formation, prepared to reinforce any weak spot. Its long face was roughly 100 yards from side to side, barely a third of the oncoming cavalry's frontage, and it looked impossibly frail in the face of such a threat. If the Carizians in that square realized that, they gave no sign of it. As Windshare's cavalry charge poured down the hillside like a river of horseflesh and steel, the 150 rifles in the square's second and third ranks flamed as one. The impact of that deadly volley was staggering, and in more than one way. Every man in Windshare's charge had seen those bayonets, and because they'd never heard of ring bayonets, which mounted around a rifle's muzzle instead of being shoved down into the weapon's bore, they'd known that the musketeers behind them couldn't possibly fire. The surprise, when they went right ahead and fired anyway, was total. Even if those bullets had inflicted no casualties at all, the sheer shock of experiencing yet another surprise at Carizian hands would have dealt the cavalry's confidence and determination a deadly blow. And, unfortunately for Coruscant, the Carizian bullets did inflict casualties as well. Horses were big targets. Men were relatively small ones. No more than 20 or 30 of Windshare's troopers were actually hit by the Carizian fire. Those who were hit went down hard as the massive bullets smashed through breastplates and the fragile bodies beneath them. Yet they represented only a handful of that onrushing wave's total numbers. But the horses were another matter. Holes appeared abruptly in the center of the Coruscantian line as screaming horses smashed to earth. Riders were flung out of their saddles, only to find themselves in the path of the second line of troopers behind them. Ordinarily, a horse will do almost anything to avoid colliding with a human, but there was no way these horses could. They were moving too fast, with too much momentum, with too many other horses right behind them, and they trampled the dismounted cavalrymen into bloody mud. The bodies of the fallen horses were a more serious obstacle, and the face of the charging formation splintered as the horses, still on their feet, tried frantically to avoid the tangled wreckage of their dead and wounded fellows. Many of them failed, plowing into the barrier, shrieking as legs broke, riders went flying, and fresh, thrashing bodies were added to the heap. Johnston had timed his volley almost perfectly. There was time enough to break the cavalry's momentum, distance enough for the leading edge of the charge to spread out around the sudden obstacle and lose cohesion, but too little time for it to begin to recover. And, just as horses will instinctively seek to avoid trampling a downed human, they have a pronounced aversion to charging straight into the solid barrier of a glittering wall of sharpened steel. With their momentum broken, their ranks staggered, their riders unnerved, they refused the challenge. Instead, they split around the square, flowing down its short sides, and fresh rifle volleys ripped out as their momentum carried them across the flank platoon's field of fire. Then they were past the square, and its rear wall fired a deadly volley into their backs. There wasn't time for Windshare to even begin to analyze what had happened to his first wave before his second wave came thundering in 10 seconds later. Those 10 seconds hadn't been quite long enough for the firing ranks to reload, but the kneeling front rank hadn't fired against the first wave. Now, the second rank advanced its bayonets at the thrust, reaching well forward over the heads of the front rank, while that front rank raised its rifles and fired its own vicious volley at point-blank range. It was only half as heavy as the volley which had broken the first charge, but it was enough to stagger the second, especially with the writhing drift of dead and wounded horses and bodies from the first double line's wreckage to help disorder the Coruscantian formation. And the surviving horses of the second wave were no more eager than their fellows had been to thrust themselves against those waiting bayonets. They fought their riders, and even as they did, the square's third rank finished reloading, leveled its rifles, and fired at a range of less than 30 feet. The carnage was incredible, yet even in the midst of the blood, the smoke, and the screams, some of Windshare's troopers actually managed to close with the Marines. Lances crossed with bayoneted muskets, swords flashed, and blood splashed across the grassy hillside. And then the third wave plowed into the melee. In most places, the square held. Unshaken infantry in tight formation and under firm tactical control stood an excellent chance against cavalry. It was broken infantry, or an unsteady formation, which formed cavalry's legitimate prey, and the Carizians refused to be broken. Yet the Coruscantians were just as determined, and Carizians began to die as well. A hole opened in the square's front as Windshare's third line slammed home. One of the reserve platoons moved quickly to seal the gap, but half a dozen Coruscantian horsemen burst through it before they could. Brigadier Clarake's command group were the only mounted troops under his command, and he slapped home his heels, spurring to meet the breakthrough with his staff officers. One rider had started moving an instant before the hole actually opened, however. He wore the black-and-gold kraken on the blue checkerboard shield of the Carizian Imperial Guard, and his katana flashed in his hand. He went into the oncoming Coruscantians like a battering ram, and a head flew. Before that first head hit the ground, Merlin's blade had claimed a second. He passed through them like the Archangel of Death, then drove his horse directly into the gap and flung himself from the saddle to wield his sword two-handed, while Clarake and his staffers dealt with the two Coruscantians he hadn't killed on his way through. In the handful of seconds it took for the reserve platoon to reach him, he killed another 9 men. The Earl of Windshare found himself unhorsed once more, and this time with no dislocated shoulder. The bayonet wound in his right thigh bled badly, and he sat up, squeezing the leg with both hands, trying to staunch the flow of blood. Horses stamped and reared and screamed all about him. Steel beat on steel with the dull, hideous blacksmith sound of a battlefield's death mill in full production. But he could feel the battle's tempo. When the hole had opened, he'd hoped they might still at least break this square. Now he knew they wouldn't. The shock of the Carizians' preposterously rapid response, the fact that they'd been able to fire after all, and the effectiveness of their fire, had broken his men's resolve, and he could already hear additional rifles and artillery firing from farther down the slope, where two more Carizian battalions had deployed into a standard firing line to cover the square's flanks with their preposterously long-range fire. He could also make out the sound of his own bugles still blowing the charge, sending more of his men forward into the maelstrom, and something inside him cringed at the thought. Even if his men kept trying, all they could accomplish would be to die in even greater numbers, and some instinct warned him, and he looked up just as one of those shrieking horses reared high and then came toppling down straight at him. There was nothing he could do, but then a human-shaped hand closed on the back of his weapon's harness, and his eyes went wide as it effortlessly yanked him out of the falling horse's path. He found himself being supported with one hand by a tall, broad-shouldered Carizian in the black and gold of the House of Armach. He had no idea what an Imperial Guardsman was doing in the midst of this insane carnage, but however the man had gotten there, he'd just saved Windshare's life. And as the Earl watched, the sword in the Carizian's other hand cut off one man's arm and took another's head.
"Don't be silly," a corner of his brain told him. "No one can do that one-handed. You're wounded. Blood loss can make a man imagine all kinds of things."
Then, charging out of the confusion, a platoon of Carizian marines appeared to seal the opening in the square's front, and Windshare felt himself being dragged back from the fighting.
"I apologize for the rough treatment, my lord," the man hauling him to safety said, "but I think General Garvai would prefer you alive."
3. Telesburg Palace, City of Telesburg, Old Kingdom of Karras.
"Well, I'd say we have our work cut out for us, Your Majesty," Regis Yawen said quietly, as he stood beside Empress Charlian and watched the ballroom fill.
The two of them were ensconced in a waiting room off Telesburg Palace's grand ballroom. They'd chosen this particular waiting room because the artfully arranged and wrought ornamental grillwork in the wall between it and the far larger ballroom allowed someone inside the waiting room to watch the ballroom without being seen in return. And they'd chosen the grand ballroom for today's assembly because there wasn't another room in the palace large enough for their requirements.
"I don't understand why you should take that position, my lord," Charlian said with a slightly lopsided smile. "Surely all these loyal servants of the Carisian and Chisomian crowns couldn't possibly have assembled in anything less than the wholehearted spirit of cooperation. I certainly don't expect anything less out of them."
She elevated her nose with a slight but clearly audible sniff, and Earl Grey Harbor turned to smile up at her.
"Your Majesty," he said, "I trust you won't take this in the wrong spirit, but I don't think you should consider changing vocations. You'd make a very poor salesman if you can't learn to lie better than that."
"For shame, my lord," she scolded.
"Oh, trust me, your Majesty," he assured her with a gracious bow. "No one will ever be able to discern the way I really think about these people. Unlike you, I'd make an excellent salesman."
Charlian chuckled and shook her head at him, but when she turned back to the grill covering their peephole, she had to admit Grey Harbor had a point.
"And the reason he does is mainly thanks to Chisholm," she acknowledged sourly.
She had no fears where the Carisian delegates to the new Imperial Parliament were concerned. Well, very few fears, at any rate. There were a handful of them she could have done without, but all of them had been selected by a joint committee of the Lords and Commons. In Carus, those two bodies had a tradition of actually working together cooperatively, and their members, by and large, considered themselves accountable to their colleagues, so it was unlikely any of them would ignore their official instructions. There'd been some tiffs and one or two knock-down, drag-out fights, especially over which of the kingdom's nobles should be seated in the new Imperial House of Lords. And there'd been a few disagreements, and quite a bit of political dragon trading, over who would replace the representatives named to the new Imperial House of Commons in the Carisian House of Commons. For the most part, however, all of those disputes had been settled relatively amicably. No one was completely happy with the final list of selections, but no one was completely unhappy with it either, and that was almost certainly the best anyone could reasonably have expected. Chisholm, however, hadn't done things quite the same way. The letter from Green Mountain and Charlian's mother had apologized profusely for that, but she knew she couldn't really blame them. For that matter, she couldn't blame Caleb either, though a part of her was just a bit frustrated because she couldn't. His decision to stay out of the selection process had undoubtedly been the correct one, even if it had left her with a sticky, potentially nasty mess. The Chisomian Commons had been quite willing to cooperate with their own Chamber of Lords, but the Lords had flatly refused to cooperate with the Commons. They and they alone would decide which of their members would be sent to Telesburg to represent them in the new Parliament.
"And that's exactly why they're going to be such a pain in my posterior," Charlian thought grimly. "They aren't here to represent Chisholm. They're here to represent themselves."
Well, it wouldn't be the first time she'd crossed swords with the Chisomian nobility, and this time she had some truly formidable allies.
"And so, my Lord Speaker, I most urgently request that this body give its immediate attention to this matter."
Charlian grimaced as she leaned back in the comfortable chair in the same waiting room she and Grey Harbor had occupied that morning. There were a great many other urgent tasks upon which she could have been spending her limited time, but she badly wanted to hear at least the first day's deliberations with her own ears. She trusted Grey Harbor and Archbishop Michael, both of whom were formal members of the Imperial Parliament the delegates were attempting to organize, and for the most part, she would be completely satisfied with their reports as the organizational meetings proceeded. For now, though, she wanted to get a feel for the delegates' mood and where those deliberations of theirs were likely to go. "What I really want," she admitted to herself grumpily, "is to be in there, kicking their posteriors, or possibly shooting one or two of them out of hand to get this job done right." In the end, she and Caleb would almost certainly get pretty much what they wanted. She knew that, and if anyone in that ballroom-turned-meeting chamber thought otherwise, they would soon discover differently. Unfortunately, she couldn't just dictate her own terms and decisions, not if she wanted this new parliament's legitimacy to be fully accepted by its own members, much less the rest of the empire. These people, however irritating some of them might be, were the representatives of the empire's subjects. If they were truly going to represent lords and commoners, then they must be allowed to voice their own opinions, organize their own affairs, and reach their own decisions. If the Crown disagreed with those decisions, then it was clearly the Crown's job to do something about that, but not by brazenly setting aside or openly trampling upon them, and not without listening to them and attempting to work with them first, since it was highly likely that they had something worth saying, even if it wasn't what the Crown wanted to hear. No matter how exhausting, frustrating, and just plain irritating it could be. For that matter, Charlian reflected with a lopsided smile, sitting out here instead of in there may actually be doing me some good. I can work off, or at least work through, the worst of my temper tantrums before I have to start dealing with them. That wasn't a minor consideration, and the man who had just finished speaking and resumed his seat was an excellent example of why it wasn't. Pate Styrett, the Duke of Blackhorse, had ambitions, which were less well concealed than he apparently thought, to succeed where the previous Duke of Three Hills had failed. Nor was he alone in that. He and the man seated next to him, Jason Seafarer, the Duke of Rockcoast, were close allies in the Chisomian House of Lords. Not too surprisingly, Charlian supposed, given the fact that their dukedoms neighbored one another in southwestern Chisholm, and their families had been intermarrying for generations. Or that both of them were about as stubborn, pig-headed, and short-sighted as it was possible for a breathing human being to be. For that matter, she suspected most corpses were less pig-headed than they were. And yet, by the oddest turn of fate, both of them, and the almost equally revolting, from Charlian's perspective, Earl of Dragon Hill, had been chosen by their fellow peers to represent them in Telisburg. Fortunately, Sir Adam Geoffrey, the Earl of Cross Creek, had also slipped through the selection process somehow. Cross Creek was the Earl of White Crag's brother-in-law, and one of the senior members of the Chamber of Lords, who was actually a stalwart ally of the Crown. At the moment, Duke Blackhorse was staking out the grounds for what Charlian had anticipated from the beginning would be one of the Chamber of Lords' tactics. There were far fewer dukes and earls and far more barons in Carus than in Chisholm, and the marriage contracts which had created the empire had specified that all pre-existing patents of nobility would remain unchanged, and, upon the formal merger of the two crowns, would become imperial titles. Now the Chisomian peers were taking the position that seats in the new Imperial Parliament's House of Lords should be assigned strictly on the basis of precedence of title, without regard as to the kingdom from which the holders of those titles might come. It was a brazen attempt to ensure that the Chisomian aristocracy would dominate the new parliament's upper house, and while Charlian had anticipated a move in this direction, she hadn't expected them to try pushing it this quickly. Admittedly, Black Horse had much in common with a dragon in a glassworks, but he'd learned at least a modicum of tactical timing in Chisholm. Surely he should have had the wit to realize it would only be prudent to at least test the waters here in Telesburg before he plunged in headlong, and to remember that the heraldic symbol of Karis was a kraken. "Apparently not," she thought tartly, "which doesn't exactly break my heart. If there are any Carisian nobles with delusions of power-grabbing, this should at least ensure that they don't think they can cut some sort of deal with my idiot aristocracy." In fact, she could already see quite a few fulminating Carisian peers. Obviously, the Chamber of Lords' tactic hadn't come as a complete surprise to them either. Not that having anticipated it made the Carisians any less irked when their anticipation was confirmed. And not that realizing Black Horse had jumped too quickly made what he was saying one bit less irritating to Charlian. He and his allies had wrapped their proposal up in the camouflage of her own and Caleb's insistence that there was no senior or junior partner in the merger of their two kingdoms. If Chisholm and Karis were truly going to merge into a single entity, Black Horse was arguing, then the national boundaries which had once separated them would no longer exist. All of their peers should be considered members of a single unified peerage, just as all the commoners from both of the now legally deceased realms should be eligible for election to the new House of Commons. And if that was the case, then obviously the seats in the new House of Lords ought to be assigned strictly on the basis of precedence of title, without regard to whether it was a Chisomian or Carisian title. After all, were they not all to become the loyal servants of a single united crown? "Just like that lying Cretan," she thought waspishly. "But does he actually think this noble Patriot Act is going to fool anyone? I'd like to loyal his servant. And I've got a dungeon cell somewhere which would fit him just fine. I'm sure I do, even if Caleb did forget to tell me where it was. Maybe if I ask Rages, he can..."
"My Lord Speaker," another voice said, and Charlian's grimace eased just a bit as Samuel Jackson, the Duke of Halleck, asked for recognition. Halleck was one of the relatively small handful of Carisians whose titles would take precedence over virtually any Chisomian. Indeed, he, the Duke of Corinth, and the youthful Duke of Tirion were three of the four most senior noblemen of the entire Old Kingdom of Karis, and all three of them had been chosen as delegates, despite the fact that young Regis Armach, the Duke of Tirion, was barely 12 years old. Obviously, the choices had been made expressly because the Carisians had expected something like this. Although, Charlian smiled rather nastily, the fact that young Regis's regent was his grandfather, the Earl of Grey Harbor, had probably had a little something to do with it as well.
"His Grace, the Duke of Halleck, is recognized," the speaker announced, and Halleck nodded gravely in thanks.
"While I feel confident that I speak for most of my fellow Carisians, I beg pardon, for my fellow old Carisians, for as His Grace of Black Horse has just pointed out, we are all Carisians today, when I say that I wholeheartedly approve of our Chisomian fellow subjects' willingness to accept that we are all now a single empire and no longer separate kingdoms, I fear Duke Blackhorse may be getting just a bit ahead of himself.
With all due respect, and while fully agreeing that the Empire has already come into existence, I invite His Grace's attention to the marriage agreement between His Majesty and Her Majesty. In particular, I note in Section 4 that it is specifically stated that the crowns of Chisholm and Karis will not be formally united until both of them are inherited by their Majesty's heir. As every patent of nobility in Old Karis is currently held in fealty to the King of Karis, and every patent of nobility in Chisholm is currently held in fealty to the Queen of Chisholm, we cannot, however much we might wish to, consider them to be part of a seamless whole at this time.
Black Horse scowled. Rockcoast didn't seem much happier, although Edward Albert, the Earl of Dragon Hill, was actually nodding gravely, his lips pursed in obvious thought. Then again, Dragon Hill had always been a smoother operator than either of the two dukes.
Indeed, Halleck continued, unless I misread Section 3 of the marriage contract rather badly, the function of this assembly is to organize our new imperial parliament with what might most accurately be described as a House of Lords and a House of Commons, each of which has two chambers, one whose membership is drawn from Old Karis, and one whose membership is drawn from Chisholm. All of the members of that new imperial parliament will, of course, be equal colleagues of one another, regardless of the kingdom from which they may come. But my own strong feeling at this time is that the membership of those two chambers in each house ought to be determined by the parliament of the kingdom which they will be representing. I believe it would be presumptuous of us at this time to make any attempt to dictate to either of those sovereign bodies. Surely it would constitute an unjustified infringement upon their prerogatives and ancient legal rights and responsibilities.
Halleck seated himself, and there was a buzz of side conversations. The majority of them were approving, judging from their tone, and Charlian chuckled as she watched Black Horse's expression.
Did he really think Carisians were too stupid to have anticipated something quite that obvious? She wondered scornfully. Of course he, and Rockcoast and Dragon Hill, are all three stupid enough to go on hoping that they're going to be able to wiggle out from under the foot Marak, Mother, and I have firmly on the backs of their necks in Chisholm. So maybe they were dumb enough to think they could get away with something like this so quickly.
She shook her head, and then her eyes narrowed as she saw Black Horse's head twitch in the direction of yet another Chisholmian nobleman. Sir Patrick Macnee, the Duke of Lakeland, was gazing attentively at the speaker, apparently oblivious to Black Horse, but Charlian felt an abrupt prickle of suspicion. At 36, Lakeland was no callow youth, yet he was very new to his title. His father had been killed in a fall from a horse when Lakeland was only 11, which had made him his grandfather's heir. But that grandfather, who had died less than a year ago, had been well over 80 and still vigorous, still fully in charge of his duchy and all its responsibilities, up to the very day of his death. The previous duke had also been closely allied with Black Horse and Rockcoast, longing for the good old days of Erwain III, which he had remembered only too well. Despite his mental vigor, however, he'd been understandably frail, no longer up to the demands of making long journeys to the capital. And Sir Patrick had always been a dutiful grandson, carrying out his grandfather's instructions to the letter whenever he had deputized for the old man in Parliament Hall. The assumption had been that he agreed with those instructions, but Charlian was suddenly less certain of that.
I've always known he was smarter than his grandfather, she thought. Is it possible that he's also a lot sneakier? And that perhaps, Just perhaps he wasn't in agreement with his grandfather's political ambitions all these years. If he wasn't, and if he was both smart and sneaky enough not to let his grandfather's allies realize that he wasn't, perhaps she'd been wronging Black Horse just a bit. It had still been a particularly stupid opening move, but was it possible the stupidity hadn't been entirely self-grown? That someone else, someone like the Duke of Lakeland, might have suggested the ploy to him to deliberately maneuver him and his allies into a false step, one which would make it crystal clear to everyone, Carizian and Chisomian alike, exactly where that line of battle was going to be drawn. "I really have to get to know Lakeland a little better," she told herself. "If he's truly that devious, I need to make certain he really is on the crown side, too. Caleb and I certainly don't need him on the other side."
4. Empress Charlian's Dining Chamber, Telesburg Palace, City of Telesburg, Old Kingdom of Karas.
"Well, I think that probably went rather better than you'd anticipated, Regis," Charlian said cheerfully, much later that evening, as she dined with Grey Harbor and Archbishop Michael. "Actually, Your Majesty," Grey Harbor pointed out in a gently corrective tone, "I think it went rather better than either of us had anticipated."
"Nonsense," Charlian chuckled.
"I never doubted for a moment." "Remember what I said about career changes, Your Majesty."
Charlian laughed out loud and shook her head. Then she emptied her wine glass, and the Archbishop refilled it for her.
"Thank you, Your Eminence," she said.
"You're entirely welcome, Your Majesty, although, as a priest, I must feel some slight concern for the state of your soul if you continue to prevaricate the way you just did."
"Oh, no, Your Eminence, you're quite wrong. I didn't prevaricate at all. I lied."
"Oh, that's much better."
Stainer's eye twinkled.
"Or more direct, at least."
"I try, Your Eminence."
"Indeed you do, Your Majesty," Grey Harbor agreed. "And if I may be permitted to steer this conversation into slightly more serious territory, you have a point about how well things went today."
"I know." Charlian leaned back in her chair, her own expression more serious, and nodded. "Were either of you watching Black Horse after Duke Halleck cut his legs off?"
"What a charming turn of phrase, Your Majesty," Stainer observed.
She made a face at him, and he smiled, then shook his head.
"Actually, I must confess that I wasn't. May I ask why?"
"Because I'm not at all certain his stupidity was entirely his own idea," Charlian said.
She explained her own thoughts about the Duke of Lakeland, and both the First Counselor and the Archbishop looked thoughtful when she'd finished.
"Obviously, Your Majesty, you know both Black Horse and Lakeland far better than Michael or I do," Grey Harbor said. "I'd certainly like to think you're right about this, though. Frankly, I suspect that arm-wrestling your Chisomian nobleman is going to get exhausting fairly quickly."
"It may," Stainer said. "Then again, it may not. Obviously, if Your Majesty is right about Lakeland, it means we've managed to acquire an ally behind enemy lines, as it were. On the other hand, Halleck's point that we can scarcely dictate to either kingdom's parliament without infringing its prerogatives was a particularly nasty thumb in the eye for Black Horse and his friends. It wouldn't happen, would it, that you and he might have discussed that before this morning's session?"
"I suppose it's remotely possible," Grey Harbor admitted.
"I thought I detected your touch," Stainer smiled. At any rate, it's probably going to cause at least some of Black Horse's more conservative fellows to think hard about whether or not they want to undermine their own prerogatives back home. And I have to admit that I've been rather pleasantly surprised by the attitude of Archbishop Powell's delegates.
You have? Charlian looked at him.
Assuredly, Your Majesty.
The Archbishop inclined his head in a seated bow.
On several levels. First and foremost, because I've detected no reservations on their part about the legitimacy of our quarrel with the Temple Loyalists. One or two of them, obviously, have major concerns about precisely where we may be headed in a theological and doctrinal sense, but they clearly support our basic position about the corruption of Mother Church. Archbishop Powell's letters make it quite clear that he feels the same, and that he's readily prepared to accept the Church of Corus's existing hierarchy and the primacy of the Archbishop of Tellisburg, which is nothing to sneeze at. Emerald has already done the same thing, of course, but despite Princess Maria's betrothal to young Jean, the fact remains that most of the world is going to see Emerald as essentially a conquered province. Clinton and Trenaire will be able to argue fairly convincingly that Caleb constrained the Emeraldian Church to accept the Church of Corus. That's not the case in Chisholm, or at least not nearly as much the case. That makes Archbishop Powell's willingness to openly and willingly accept the Chisholmian Church's position within the church hierarchy both far more valuable and more courageous. He can't hide behind the threat of Corisian bayonets, can't pretend we made him do it, yet he's openly embraced the schism and its implications. The attitude of his representatives convinces me his letter is completely sincere as well. Mind you, he's already drawn my attention to several areas in Chisholm where both firmness and patience and wariness are going to be required. But overall, he's managed to put to rest most of my most pressing concerns. On another level, however, and the one which actually brought it to mind at the moment, I've also read his instructions to his representatives where the Imperial Parliament is concerned. Essentially, they've been instructed to take their lead from myself in political as well as temporal matters, and he's impressed upon them that it is his desire, as their Archbishop, for them to assist the Crown in whatever ways may be possible.
Oh, good. Charlian nodded in satisfaction. Marak, Baron Green Mountain, and Mother both told me they expected something very like that from him. I'm glad to see they were right.
They most certainly were, Your Majesty.
And, Grey Harbor said, his satisfaction undisguised, the delegates from the Chamber of Commons are already forming workable partnerships with their counterparts here in Corus. Jacques Blackwyvern and Sir Samuel Waysman tell me that they've already been in conversation with a Willem Watson and Tobias Samuelson, Your Majesty. I know both of them well, Charlian nodded again. Watson especially has been one of Marak's closer allies in the Commons for years. I'm not a bit surprised he's taking the offensive here in Tellisburg, as it were.
It's my impression that that's exactly what he's doing, Grey Harbor agreed. Although Jacques tells me he's gotten the impression that Master Samuelson may have more substantial reservations about our schismatic policies than Master Watson does.
Really? Charlian frowned slightly, then gave her head a little toss. That could well be. Tobias is an extraordinarily loyal man by nature. He isn't the very smartest man in the world, but he's uncommonly level-headed, which is one reason he and Watson usually work in tandem. Watson can be downright brilliant, but he can also be a bit erratic from time to time. Tobias helps keep him centered. But Tobus also extends that loyalty of his to more than just the crown. In fact, that's one of the things I've always liked most about him. He brings that same steadiness, that same sense of responsibility to all of the important things in his life. And the church is important to him.
Is that likely to become a problem, Your Majesty?
Grey Harbor's eyes were much more serious than they had been.
From what Jacques had to say, both he and Sir Samuel believe Watson and Samuelson may well be the two most important delegates from the Chamber of Commons.
They almost certainly are the two most important delegates, Charlian agreed. And I suspect that one reason Tobus was chosen was because the other members of the chamber know he has at least some doubts about the schism. He'll abide by whatever instructions they sent with him, or at least, if he decides he can't abide by them in good conscience, he'll resign and withdraw from the process rather than violate them. But I'm sure there are quite a few other chamber members who have reservations of their own. They trust his integrity, and they also trust him to address those reservations.
Should I seek to set to rest any concerns he might have, Your Majesty?
Stainer asked quietly.
I think that would be a very good idea, Charlian said after a moment. I don't think you're going to have to go looking for him, though, Your Eminence. Unless I'm very mistaken, he's going to come to you. As I say, he's very level-headed. And I believe, now that I've thought about it, that he'll probably want to discuss those reservations of his directly with you at the earliest possible moment. And I think he'll do his best to listen to what you have to say with an open mind when he does.
I can ask no more than that of any man.
Stainer smiled another of his serene smiles.
If he's truly willing to listen, I expect God will be able to make himself heard, even if he has to use a fallible conduit like myself.
Charlian shook her head. In most men in Stainer's position, that last sentence would have been an example of pure false modesty. In Michael Stainer's case, it was entirely genuine.
You may not be able to ask more than that of any man, Michael.
Grey Harbor's voice was considerably more sour than the Archbishop's.
But I could wish that you got it a bit more often.
And what brought that on, my lord?
Charlian asked, quirking an eyebrow.
That idiot Kyrie, Your Majesty,
Grey Harbor growled.
I wish I knew what the Commons were thinking when they added him to their list of delegates.
Charlian grimaced. Travier Kyrie was one of the handful of Carisian delegates about whom she cherished serious reservations. She, too, had wondered what could possibly have inspired the rest of the House of Commons to choose him to help speak for them, and she still hadn't been able to come up with an answer she liked.
Most of it was simply wealth talking, Regis, Stainer said,
his tone considerably calmer than the first counselor's.
Do I really have to explain to you just how many other members of the House of Commons owe him money, favors, or both?
No, Grey Harbor groused.
Well, I think that's probably the primary reason right there.
The Archbishop shrugged slightly.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he called most of those favors in to get himself selected.
I have to say I agree with Regis, Charlian said, and the harshness in her voice surprised even her just a bit. Charlian Tate Armagh had come to love Carus, and most of the things about it. Not everything, of course, but most things. Travier Kyrie, on the other hand, represented almost everything she disliked about Carus. He was fabulously wealthy, due as much to his father's efforts as to his own, and every negative stereotype the rest of Safehold cherished about Carisians fitted him like a glove. He was greedy, scheming, and totally unconcerned about the well-being of his workforce. He was one of the manufactory owners who'd campaigned most vigorously against the new child labor laws, and she knew Edward Hausman and Ryan McHale both despised him and didn't particularly care who knew it. From all she could see, he felt exactly the same way about them, with the addition of intense resentment for the fact that both of them were substantially more wealthy even than he was. Charlian would have been prepared to regard the man distastefully on that basis alone, but she had her own deeply personal and individual reasons for loathing Kyrie.